Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, supposed to be weekly program of science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. This morning, actually, almost none of the above, or all of the above. A lot of Steel Ice Band, a remembrance of Margot Adler, and a movie review by Dan Christmas. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. Oh, well. I haven't gotten... That was going to segue right into the movie review, you know? And this space is not yet really acclimated to us. I was talking with Kathy Davis about trying to acclimate to this room. And it's the best word that we can use for it is makeshift. Right now, I've got a thumb drive in my hand with most of the material for tonight's show. And I am bending over trying to figure out which of these three computers I need to plug the thumb drive into. And I also always invariably have a tendency to plug my thumb drive into the wrong place, which is, well, the story of many people's lives. Okay, now did that work? I'm now on a different computer. And, yes. Oop. Why is it going to autoplay? No, don't do that. Don't do that, computer. Thank you. All righty. So, that brings up the subtext of not just the morning's show, but the week's discussion, the fortnight's discussion, I should say, which is the ability of WBAI to broadcast conscientiously and properly. Ooh, there's an interesting noise. You hear that? It's like a copy machine. And that's just the point. We don't have soundproofing here. We don't even have walls in this so-called studio that reach the ceiling. What we are doing is inhabiting a room with closed doors, but still open to the, well, you know, let's put it this way. I'm about, I figure 20 or 30 yards from the front of the building here. And if a motorcycle group were to ride down Atlantic Avenue, which, by the way, they do sometimes with alarming frequency because it's not that far off the Brooklyn Queens Expressway, you would all enjoy the sound of that at the same time as I. How do we get out of this rut? Well, the answer is we build a studio. How do we build a studio? Well, the answer is that you call area code 212-209-2950 and pledge to WBAI. And we actually do have a premium for this morning, though it doesn't really fit into this morning's theme, but it will in a way. We're about to hear a movie review. And what we have is a recording of all the movie reviews that Dan Persons and before him Genevieve Valentine have done for Hour of the Wolf over the last, say, 4 or 5 years. And for that, we are asking but a mere $45. Well, why $45? It's an arbitrary number. I chose it because, well, we need more than just the $25 it takes to become a subscriber to WBAI, because actually when I started here at BAI as a phone volunteer in, Lord help me, 1967, that was the price. It was $45 to become a subscriber, $25 if you are a student, retired, or unemployed, and it was free to prisoners. So I'm asking you to be a throwback and pay more, $45, and we will send you a CD with all of the movie reviews from Hour of the Wolf over the last few years as a thank you gift for your gift to WBAI. You gift to us, we gift to you. That's exactly how it works. So 212-209-2950. And I'm going to be doing some other throwback stuff this morning during the show. And, well, just bear with it. I think you'll enjoy some of it. Some of it may be a little bit teary, but a lot of it will be really good. So I think I've got the movie review ready, and stay tuned.
I'll admit it. I went into Ant-Man
with an agenda. Well, let's try that again, okay? I had very skillfully turned down the volume on that player from during the segue between the two shows. And, of course, started this silently. Let's hear it this time.
I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. I'll admit it. I went into Ant-Man with an agenda. Well, actually, I always go into movies with an agenda, but it's a simple one, just that I want the freaking thing to be entertaining. But in this case, there was an additional one. If the filmmakers didn't take full advantage of the 3D process in Ant-Man, then really, there actually is no point to the format. Ant-Man is about a reformed burglar played by Paul Rudd, who stumbles upon a suit that shrinks him down to the size of an ant. You did hear the title, didn't you? Anyway, director Peyton Reed has a perfect excuse to use 3D to heighten the audience's vertiginous experience of a world where cracks in the floor become insurmountable caverns and ants grow to the size of tractor trailers. If he can't do that, he may as well go home. To a great extent, Reed pays off on the promise. Not consistently, but certainly it's there the first time Rudd's character, Scott Lang, accidentally shrinks down, a fun kinetic sequence that starts in the infinite wide expanse of a bathtub and quickly flings Lang into such pitfalls as floods, killer rodents, and the deadly gauntlet of a club's dance floor. It's also there mostly in the finale, which works some variations on the theme as Lang deploys grenades that can grow and shrink inanimate objects, and as director Reed quick cuts between everyday and Ant-Man perspectives, getting comic gold out of how a genuine life-or-death struggle between Lang and Corey Stoll's also miniaturized bad guy Yellowjacket would look to the average eye. I wish there was actually more to that type of stuff. I suspect if Edgar Wright, who gets screenplay credit along with Joe Cornish, Adam McKay, and Paul Rudd, had stayed on to direct as he was originally supposed to, he would have found more ways to work those variants. As it is, Reed, who has a respectable background in film and TV comedy, does do well. The chemistry between Rudd, Michael Douglas as the maverick industrialist who invented the magic shrinky suit, that's the technical name for it, and Evangeline Lilly as his semi-estranged daughter is great. And Marvel in general does better with comedy than DC, keeping sight that it needs to be character-based. There is a little discomfort in the portrayal of Lang's fellow compatriots in burglary. Even taking into account that this is a comic book movie, the multicultural trio is a little too broadly stereotyped. It's never bad enough to be truly offensive, just kind of lazy. And the plot, once again, is off the rack. This time, it's the evil corp that wants to leverage a scientific discovery for military applications, here modified to fit into the Marvel Cinematic Universe as it presently stands post-Age of Ultron. I'd actually like to see a sequel where Vincent D'Onofrio shows up with a plan to fight wars using miniaturized velociraptors, maybe with lasers on their heads. That'd be cool. At some point, we have to talk about this whole Marvel Cinematic Universe thing, when it stops being a way of adding richness and depth to a franchise and starts feeling more like calculated upsell. Watch all the movies, keep track of all the TV shows and comic books, or be hopelessly lost. That hasn't really happened here. In the sequence where Ant-Man goes mano a mano with Anthony Mackie's Falcon from The Avengers is actually very good. No argument. Ant-Man is fun, it's entertaining, it's frequently very funny, and it takes good filmic advantage of a character who can see the world from a different perspective, including a brief but wonderfully psychedelic dip into a realm of quantum physics. It goes the distance and breaks a few boundaries, and that's cool enough. I'm Dan Persons. Remember, we are archiving these reviews over at my My Teen Movie Podcast website. So check out what you missed by going to MyTeenMoviePodcast.com.
And thank you, Dan. And that's... You call 212-209-2950. And, or go to WBAI.org and look for where to pledge and pull down what show you are pledging for, which is Hour of the Wolf, and ask for Hour of the Wolf movie reviews for $45, or just make a donation to WBAI for $25 or more, or be generous, give us $100, because we need a freaking studio here. It would be nice to feel like a radio station again instead of WBAI in exile, which has happened way too often through the years to suit me. And, you know, as I reminisce, as I be, you know, secondary to Bob Fass, and Janet Coleman, for that matter, and David Dozer, one of the old-time people of WBAI. I began here at age 13 as a phone volunteer in 1967. And it was not long after that that I discovered, for possibly the third time in my life, but the first time that we were actually bona fide introduced to Margot Adler. And in 1972, Margot created what became the regular program, Hour of the Wolf, which is the title of the show you are now listening to. She made a deal with the station manager to go on unemployment, and she continued doing work in the news department. And then took over the 5 to 7 a.m. time, which was normally off the air. We used to go off the air whenever Bob Fass or Steve Post, who were the midnight people, felt that it was time for them to turn off the transmitter. It was usually somewhere after 3, but it could be somewhere even after 5. And Margot created this thing, which turned WBAI into a 24-hour-a-day radio station. After a couple of years, I took the slot over. And Margot did other programs in late 70s. She started at NPR pretty much with its inception, within a year of its inception. And then, at a certain point, NPR said, listen, no moonlighting, only us or them. And, of course, NPR was paying her a good salary. But there was always a time that Margot felt, and indeed late in her life, that she wanted the freedom that a place like WBAI could afford her. There was nothing else like it. There is nothing else like it. And the existence of WBAI in some ways is tenuous. The politics, the money, the this and the that. But you know what? It's been that before, and we're still here. And we need to continue to still be here. Margot died a year and a day ago. Okay? And when she died, it was fairly devastating to me. I have known Margot, as I said, since the 60s. And I talked about it a little on the air. I did not attend the memorial. I could barely bring myself to do anything but sulk and suck my thumb at home. And after a while, I was asked through email by a woman, who, since she's the editor, I guess I can divulge her name. Lisa Feld was asked by science fiction writer Michael Burstein, who by coincidence is the brother of former WBAI producer David Burstein, to write something about Margot. And this was the end of the year. This was in December for this really actually fascinating website, all told. And I'm really annoyed that I didn't. I printed the article that I can read to you, but I did not put the URL down. But I will. I will. And actually, I think if you go to the Hour of the Wolf group on Facebook, there's a link to it there. And this is the first time that I actually formally wrote something about my feelings and was altered a great deal by Lisa Feld, as any good editor will do. And doing what good editors do, she made it better. And this is what I wrote and how it came out. Margot was 7.5 years my senior, and with the exception of a few gaps, she has always been a part of my life. There is some reason to believe that we met when I was less than 1 year old, and again when I was 10. However, our real friendship began when I was 13 and she 20. For years, we are inseparable. When she got married, we still spent time together, though we had less contact as she and John Glideman, her husband, raised their son. Over the last 7 years, we became close again, for which I am most grateful. Without her in my life, I do not know who I would have become. Outside of my partner, she is the person who's helped and supported me in the things in my life that I can hold my head up high about. Seldom was the time that I was with her that somebody wouldn't recognize her. Not necessarily as a celebrity. Radio people and writers tend not to be bothered by that particular problem, but as someone who was a friend or whose life she had directly improved. So, let's take a step back. Margot was the granddaughter of Alfred Adler, the founder of individual psychology, and for some years, the collaborator of Sigmund Freud. Her father, Kurt Adler, is best known for bringing the practice his father had developed into the U.S. I like to say that he invented the 45-minute hour. Margot was a Berkeley free speech radical in the day, as she called the 60s, majoring in political science. She began her career in journalism by working for the original Pacifica radio station KPFA as a reporter. Among her early stories was coverage of the 1965 Freedom March. Margot came back to New York City around 1967 at the age of 20 and immediately began working for WBAI, Pacifica's New York station, while doing her master's in journalism at Columbia. Stories that she reported for WBAI included her experience as a part of the 2nd Venice Ramos Brigade, a group of radicals and journalists who visited Cuba despite the embargo, cutting sugarcane and watching Castro pitch baseball. By the way, when Castro pitches, don't dig in at the plate. Glaring in challenge is a bad idea. In 1972, she made a deal with WBAI management to get her own freeform live radio show. At the time, WBAI went off the air loosely between 3 or 5 a.m. and came back on at 7. Margot talked them into giving her the 5 to 7 a.m. time slot and called it Hour of the Wolf, after the film by Ingmar Bergman, a phrase which refers to the morning twilight. I was her engineer and frequent co-host, and eventually inherited this program, which continues today. Aside from the article, well, you're listening to it now. Margot had a real intimacy with her listeners. She spoke to so many individuals in a heartening, informed, and always fascinating manner. Not to negate the brilliant work she did after this, I believe, and she indicated to me, that these were her most personally creative moments on radio. I feel truly honored to have been a part of that and to be able to carry on the program she began. In 1973, Margot was spirited away by the Clarion Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers Workshop, where her teachers included such sages as Ursula K. Le Guin, Samuel R. Delaney, and Harlan Ellison. But she was one of the few Clarion grads whose destiny did not lie in becoming a writer of fiction. Not long ago, I asked Margot why she never took up writing SF, and she replied, "I guess I've spent so much of my time searching for truth, writing fiction didn't seem like the right thing." It is during the same era that Margot became fascinated with Wicca, when she and I attended a lecture at the Blessed Bee Shop on 57th Street by a woman billing herself as Witch Wally. This was in keeping with her love for science fiction and fantasy novels and nature. It was a faith which encapsulated the things that were so important to her life and was matriarchal to boot. In fact, it is as author of Drawing Down the Moon, Witches, Druids, Goddess Worshippers, and Other Pagans in America Day, Today, published in 1979 and has never been out of print since, that Margot may have had the greatest influence on people on a deep personal level. Without that anthropological and heartfelt study, Wicca may not have gotten as strong a foothold in the U.S. as it did. In 1976, she became committed to her husband-to-be, John Glideman, who was also a friend of mine. If all that weren't enough, she began freelancing for the newly born National Public Radio while moonlighting for WBAI. In 1983, she was brought onto NPR staff, but told she could only serve one radio outlet. Outside of being a guest, her days at WBAI were over. And it is through her work for NPR that she is best known. On All Things Considered, in Morning Edition, she covered a wide variety of topics, including AIDS, religious paramilitary groups in New York City, 9/11, Harry Potter, including an interview with J.K. Rowling, birding in Central Park, and the phenomenon of vampire fiction. Margot's fascination with vampires began when her husband was diagnosed with stomach cancer. She began to explore the question of immortality. At what price might it be obtained? And the need to keep a form of your loved ones around. She read nearly 300 works of fiction in about 3 years, which culminated in her third book, Vampires Are Us, which explored her theory that vampires from different eras represent a form of desired or actual power. She also went on to lecture on this topic. About a year after John died, Margot was diagnosed with endometrial cancer. She died at age 68, a year and a day ago, July of 2014. I have never witnessed the kind of outpouring of love and mourning as I did when Margot died. To so many people, she was one of us, even though us might be from totally disparate communities. She was a bird watcher, a leader in her religious community, a speculative fiction fan, talk show host, journalist, culture lover, traveler, online personality, lecturer, mentor, friend, and so many more. This is why no one person knew all that there was to know about her. I am selfish enough to believe that I knew her better than most, but I've learned enough to know that she offered that gift to all whose life she touched. And that was the piece that I wrote last December, finally expressing some of my feelings about Margot and what she meant to me and to this station and to so many people. And so in her memory, in her name, again, I ask you to call and pledge. She often pitched on our air, including after her NPR days, and was in fact talking about a return to our air. She was certainly on Hour of the Wolf often enough in latter days as well. There came a time when, well, she didn't care. She knew what was going on, and she wanted back on BAI. And it is a sad thing that she did not come back on her own show. But fortunately, we were able to have her back here on Hour of the Wolf. And fortunately, we all were able to take part of the radio that she created. So give a call, 212-209-2950, and pledge your support for WBAI. And when asked what show you're pledging for, it's the show that Margot created, Hour of the Wolf. Margot and I, about the same time, And I should mention, by the way, because it is exactly 2 in New York, this is WBAI in New York. We both discovered the joys and blessings of the wonderful British folk revival band, Steel Eye Span. And in fact, when Margot officiated at a wedding in which I was involved as a groom some 35 years ago, we used Steel Eye Span as the music. It was something that was very important to both she and I. And for the first time in 6 years, Steel Eye performed in New York a week ago. If you're counting today as Thursday, which in New York it is, it was exactly a week ago. And it was a wonderful concert. And in a little while, we're going to hear an interview, a short interview, that I did with Matty Pryor, leader of the band. And then I'm going to talk about the concert a little bit, and we'll play you some favorite Steel Eye Span music of great importance both to me and to Adler. And that is this morning's show. But this is the song that they ended the second set of their concert with last week. And it is a beautiful song and one that I think expresses a certain sentiment that I think follows the piece that I just read. And so enjoy it. Somewhere Along the Road by Rick Kemp and Matty Pryor. Fortunately, I do have extra music, so we're going to go to that. I didn't even have my mic open there when I was apologizing for this music not playing. Oh, there it is. Totally distorted. Totally distorted.
Well,
now you understand why we're moaning and groaning about facilities here. So let me switch computers, go back to the one where I have my stuff plugged in on a thumb drive. I hear all those wonderful spiffy noises. Okay. That's a neat sound it's making. Oh, and of course that computer's gone into hibernation. Okay. Why don't we just go into some of the music that Steel Eye performed at their set, shall we? At the concert last week. And I do have this available on thumb drive and not going to depend on the internet as I have been doing but has not been playing. So, and I don't even know what version of Windows this is. This is not Win 7. So I can't just do an automatic search on a directory. Ah, but here's at least one piece that they played. Let's hear that, and I'll try to get it together, and if that's possible. And we'll be back. One of the wonderful things, one of my favorite things about Steel Eye Span are these beautiful, gorgeous melodies that they have. And did you listen to those lyrics on Cadgwith Anthem carefully? It's a song about highwaymen. It's stand and deliver and leaving Kashmir. Which I think Maddie mentioned was a place. At any rate, you know what I ought to do? I was trying to put together all these pieces of music, but I'm just realizing that what I really ought to be doing is playing the interview that I did with her. That was, you know, one of the selling points of this morning's program. And I was very, very pleased. Now, the last time they were in town, which was like in 2008, I got a full like 40 minutes before the concert. But this time, it was after the concert. I had arranged things too late to be able to get a full, you know, heads-up kind or knees-up kind of interview. But nevertheless, after the concert, after she had done a meet and greet, and it's 11 p.m. when she had gone on stage at 8, with a wonderful concert. It was, by the way, pretty much a largely new lineup of Steel Eye Span, including a new fiddler, a woman, which is wonderful, because that also means now with two female voices, there are certain songs from the early days of Steel Eye where Gay Woods and Matty Pryor were both the vocalists, where they can now do more of those early songs, and indeed they did, such as My Johnny Was a Shoemaker and Add Something to All Around My Hat and so forth. So anyway, I got about 5 minutes with Maddie after the show, and, well, instead of my talking about it, why don't we just listen to it? I'm going to right-click to bring it up separately. There we go. I'm here with Maddie Pryor, which is for me always a thrill. I hear you every week because I play you on my radio show.
Fantastic.
Sales of Silver has been since 1980 my outro music and continues to be. Except in October when it's Thomas the Rhymer.
There you go.
Because it's that time of year.
Right.
So I wanted to ask you on this tour, we spoke 6 years ago, of course you remember. I wanted to ask you, A, what mark Steel Eye Span is this?
Oh, I've no idea. I don't count.
Is it
more, I don't do numbers.
More than, I remember in one album you wrote liner notes and you said this was Steel Eye Span Mark 6. And I figured this must be 11.
Other people do this stuff. I don't do it.
Oh, okay. But it was a fabulous band.
It's a great band. Yeah.
But it still has everything it ever had.
Well, nothing stays the same. You don't want things to stay the same. It'd be boring. So we tweak the songs and we do different versions. We change them.
Yeah, but a lot of what you did tonight in the first set were the classic arrangements, I noticed. And
Bob's arrangements are very difficult to change.
Yeah.
We did manage to change to King Henry.
Yes, and in a lovely manner, too. I wanted to ask you, because I knew Terry Pratchett. He had been on my show, which is primarily science fiction and fantasy.
Oh, right.
So I interviewed him twice, and I have to say the Tiffany Aching books are among my favorites of his.
I think they're very special. I do think they're special.
Yeah.
I think his whole view of the witch's philosophy, I think, is very, it's very particular.
Yeah.
And it is how one should live one's life, really.
Yeah. I love his writing. Whenever I have anxiety, read a Discworld book.
Absolutely.
But the Aching books are something else.
They are. They're delightful. I think that they've got something fresh about them.
Yeah. And I was so happy that collaboration happened.
Yeah, it was lovely.
How involved was he in the making of
it? Well, he was very interested in it, and he wanted to we played everything to him. But we all went away and just wrote our own songs. So
yes. Yeah. And a wonderful job it was.
Yeah.
What's next for you?
Well, we're recording another album, probably the end of this year and the beginning of next year, I would think.
Approximate release?
No idea.
Okay. Coming out from Park?
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
Very good. And what kind of material are you looking at now?
I don't know yet. It's still in early stages. I never talk about material I'm working on.
Fair enough.
Because otherwise it dissipates energy.
Right. And for coming back to New York, coming across the pond again.
Well, I'd like to come back again in about a couple of years. We've left it too long this time.
Yeah, it was 6 years this time, and it was six years before that.
Yeah.
The time before the bottom line.
That's right.
So
I think it's, if we can make it work, it's just making it work. And we had a nightmare this time because of the visa situation.
Oh, no. Yeah.
Oh, well, the whole of the American embassy is in total meltdown and has been for a month, but nobody seems to know about it. It's really weird.
I was unaware of it.
Yeah, everybody's,
I'm not shocked
unaware.
To hear it.
Everybody's unaware of it. They were either hacked or they had a serious glitch, but it was shut down for a month. You couldn't get a visa.
Wow. Even as performers, or perhaps especially as performers.
Two of us did, but the rest of the band didn't. My son got sent back.
Wow.
Yeah,
that is
because we couldn't get interviews. We couldn't get, so But that's, you know, that's the nature of the job.
Yeah. Well, I hope it won't be years before you get back, and I hope that we can arrange a longer interview, because you still have a gig to do, and it's been a long night.
I know. Yeah, I must admit, I'm feeling quite tired now. Yeah.
So I and my listeners will thank you.
And thank you. Okay. Lovely to see you.
Likewise. I'm here with Maddie Pryor, which is from the Ode to Thrill. I hear you.
Smith all had our fill of the frost on the ground. Let's drink to the health of the fair summer lady and wish her the best as she draws the sun down. Go back to your mountains, you cold-hearted lover. Your magic is broken, your mischief is done. The time is at hand for the fair summer lady to take up her place and to draw down the sun. Let the season. Let the rivers start a flowing, let the hot sun burn and melt our frozen hearts. Too long have we lived in the clutches of winter, too long have we lived in the grip of the cold. One wave of a hand and the fair summer lady would turn the white fields into yellow.
One of the songs that they performed at Steel Eye Span, I should mention, at the B.B. King Blues Club, which, by the way, I really need to thank the publicity people there. I bought my ticket, let me mention, but nevertheless, when I called up to last minute to try to arrange the interview, they and Steel Eye's U.S. manager, were most helpful and forthcoming. So I just wanted to thank them on the air for the courtesies extended. So as I was saying earlier, one of the wonderful things about Steel Eyes Band is when you listen to them, there are these lovely la-la-la happy songs. The last one is a pretty one, even though, of course, in the pagan manner that is invoked in that particular Discworld novel, The Wintersmith, which is the second of what will ultimately be five Terry Pratchett novels, Terry Pratchett being somebody else we lost relatively recently and at a horribly young age to early onset Alzheimer's. And therefore a doubly maudlin thing, because it made me think of Margot and She Left Pratchett, and here's Steel Eye, having collaborated with Terry on all of this material. So that song worked. You listen to these lovely la-la-la songs, and every so often you stop and listen to the lyrics, and you go, oh my God. These are often, you know, 19th century songs, some of them even older. Very few 20th century songs in Steel Eyes Band's repertoire, unless they are original with them, such as the Wintersmith songs. And they are really, really, sometimes gory, frightening. Sometimes they have happy endings. More often, not. And here is a story of a mason who built a house for some rich people, and they refused to pay him. There are two versions of this story. In one, he is a boogeyman. He is actually a supernatural creature, something similar to a vampire. He has to be invited into the house, so he has a nurse that goes in to a house first. She gets a job, and then she invites him in. And mayhem ensues. In this version, it is a worker getting back his due from people who didn't pay him for his work. So I'm going to play that, and after that, a supernatural song. And despite the pretty lyrics, despite the pretty tunes, pay attention to the lyrics. They're wonderful. Oh, sigh. This equipment. By the way, give a call and pledge. 212-209-2950. Thank you.
never a man a-wooing when that lack of thing is three. A star of gold, an open heart and full of charity. And this was seen of King Henry, though he lay quite alone. For he's taken into a haunted hall 7 miles from the town.
He's chased the deer now him before and the doe down by the den. Till the fattest buck in all of the flock, King Henry is slain. His huntsmen followed him to the hall to make them burly cheer. When loud the wind was heard to sound and an earthquake rocked the floor. And darkness covered all the hall where they sat at the meat. The grey dogs yowling let their food and crept to Henry's feet. And louder howled the rising wind and burst the fastened door. And in there came a grisly ghost stamping on the floor. Ahead at the roof tree of the house a middle year could not span. Each frightened huntsman fled the hall and left the king alone. Her teeth were like the tether stakes, her nose like club or mell. And nothing less she seemed to be than a fiend that comes from hell. for me. Oh, you must pull the heather green and make it soft for me.
a 12-month and a day. And if anyone should ask me the reason why I'm wearing it, it's all for my true love, who's far, far away.
Call the North Wind down.
mention, by the way, that I'm so pleased we've actually raised some money for this program, $300. Do your part. 212-209-2950. And by the way, thank you, out of Canada, no less. So you don't have to be in New York to pledge. 212-209-2950.
You know this is just the beginning.
These are the ways, all the winters.
Fitting way to end this morning's tribute to both Margot Adler and to Steel Eye Span, and so much enjoyed their concert in New York last week, and hope that, true to Matty Pryor's hope, that they'll be back in a couple of years and we can do something more extended. This has been Hour of the Wolf over WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored, assuming you call 212-209-2950 and pledge. We hope that you will do so. I am not going to be on next week. There's pre-recorded pitching. But I will be back in 2 weeks. Do not be confused. The guest will be Margot Atwell, spelling her name the same way Adler did, M-A-R-G-O-T. Margot Atwell is, well, a publisher, an important person at Kickstarter, involved in, among other things, science fiction, and, yes, a roller derby queen known as M-Dash, with a new book that discusses such things. So tune in for 2 weeks. In the meantime, be good to each other, take care, and for Margot and for everybody, blessed be. Have a good fortnight. Take care.
Live from New York, it's the Gary Null Show.
It's on recording, actually.
And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today.
The Premium is a film that I have yet to release. I only had a brief fundraiser for One Night Manhattan 3 weeks ago. I have, then the following weekend, I had one in Woodstock, both of which were packed houses. And now this weekend on Long Island, I'll be at the Huntington Arts Cinema at noon to premiere it there. So outside of doing these private screenings to help as fundraisers for different groups, like it's the radio show in Woodstock that carries this program that I do every day. They're a small station, and they carry my show. They carry Guns and Butter and Richard Wolf and a few of the other programs that you hear on BAI. And I love going up to Woodstock anyhow, because it really, it's just like a regression back in the 1960s.
Yeah.
Like I said to the group, I said, you know, coming to Woodstock is like opening a closet that hasn't been opened in 40 years, and all these kind of long-haired people with, you know, with cobwebs saying, come on in. And it's a nice experience. But the film that I have just finished, that is slated for release in December on PBS stations around the country, is called Saving the Planet, One Bite at a Time. And it took a long time to do this because I had to balance two separate dynamics simultaneously. And as a filmmaker, writer, director, producer, you have to figure out, all right, what is your message? What are you trying to say? Who's going to pay attention to this message? How will it impact anyone, or will it? And so on the one hand, I'm thinking we have failed as a society to go to a meatless diet. In fact, we have more meat eating now than ever before, and we are eating more meat per person than ever before. You've seen the commercials.
Yeah.
You know, it used to be you get a hamburger, you get a hot dog, or you get a, you know, a pizza. Now it's the pizza crust has to have cheese in it or bacon in it, right?
That is crazy.
And you have to have, now I see that they have bacon and ham, which is also from the pig, just processed differently into a patty. We also then have to give them cheese and then a hamburger patty on top of that. So they're getting pork and beef. And then they get more dressings on that and two giant, and sometimes two patties. And I'm thinking, do they have any understanding that that's going to be such an assault against the body? It's all pro-inflammatory. It's extremely dangerous. And the answer is they don't. And more often than not, they don't care. All they know is that when they eat one of those, they're full and they like the taste of it. Now they're actually putting French fries on the hamburger itself.
Yeah.
And it's so big that the guy can't even hold it in two hands. And then now they also have started to put deep fried bread on it. And they've got this show called Man versus Food. Have you ever seen Man versus Food?
Oh, yeah, I've seen that. Very familiar with that show.
He's a very personable guy, and, you know, he's got a good personality, and he's showboating. And here all the people are there rooting for him. And he eats 6 pounds of food. Now, I've seen him eat 6 pounds of ice cream. I've seen him eat 6 pounds of pizzas and pastas and meat, but more often than not, it's meat. And as a nutritionist, as a dietitian, I'm a licensed dietitian, I'm a registered nutritionist, I'm board certified in clinical nutrition, I'm a PhD in the field of health and nutrition and public health science, and a research scientist, I know what happens when he takes one bite of that, let alone 6 pounds of it, into his system. It's going to cause massive, massive problems with his liver, his heart, his brain, his intestines, his stomach. In my personal opinion, he'll be lucky to be alive in 2 or 3 years from now. But here's what bothers me. It's not him eating all this that bothers me. That's his right. And I came from a family that never took any of my advice. What bothers me is what the unintended consequences are. For example, almost always these are in restaurants among the most popular restaurants in a town that are packed with people who are not eating 6 pounds worth of that, but are eating huge. We're way past supersized. We're into gigantic size, gargantuan size, mega size, you know, where you literally see people and you think, how in the world is all that food going in their body? When you see the stomach and you see how small the stomach is, and yet they're putting it in. And then we wonder why we have an epidemic of obesity, diabetes, high blood pressure, heart disease, elevated cholesterol, diverticulitis, colitis, spastic colon, dementia, and it's because of how we're feeding, what we're feeding, and the consequences. So one part of the story has to be to explain the health consequences of eating a meat-based diet. But then there's the other consequence, the animal. There's an interesting piece of the film that didn't make it in for the premiere, but will be in the televised version. In fact, there's this was really unique. There is a very popular music festival down in Austin, and Austin's one of the most progressive cities, if not the most progressive city in America to live in. I mean, no one moves to New York for health or happiness. This is not the city to live in.
Right, right.
You know, you come to New York for career, for creating a standard of living, for being able to identify yourself within your field. There's a lot of good reasons to be in New York, and there are a lot of good good people in New York. But health is not one of them. But Austin is one of those places that's got it all. I mean, it's got everything going on for it. You got more progressive things going on in Austin in a given evening you have in New York and Los Angeles combined. And it's a tiny town. So at this music festival, there was a bunch of young people, young meaning 18 to 25. Okay. And they were asked to put on headsets and listen to and watch a video of how animals that they were eating, because up there you also see sandwiches, you know, like a hot dog, hamburger, you know, the pizzas with the pepperoni, to see what they were eating. Now, before they did this, they loved the food. Then you start watching the horror on their faces. They see how the animals are treated. And they're repelled by it. Many of them were crying, had to take their headset off, couldn't watch anymore. Mm. So then the question is, now that you know where your food comes from, do you still want it? And most said no. Now, whether or not that's no for that moment, but yes the next day, we don't know. But it got their attention, every single one. Every single man and woman was shocked, mortified by the experience those animals were going through. And they all said the same thing, I didn't know. And then you get the opposite end. You go into some of the organic markets, like the farmers markets, and you'll see free-range hens, you know, uncaged hens. Okay, we filmed in a house that had uncaged hens. There are 500,000 of them. They see no light of day. They're all on this dirty floor. They're not in a cage, but they're still in a completely unsanitary and extremely stressed environment. Or you see the cow that's eating genetically engineered grain, but it's not in a stall. So it's a free-range cow, pasture-fed. But there's pesticide sprayed on the pastures. Mm. The pesticide goes in the meat. And there's the dairy cow that is given bovine stimulating growth hormones to give more milk. And it gets udders infections. And then the udder infection means that there's pus in the milk. So most people don't realize when you're drinking milk or eating cheese, you're also consuming pus.
Right.
And antibiotics and growth stimulating hormones. So when you show the truth about how animals are treated and how cruel it is, and then you see that these are sentient beings, these animals have consciousness. And there's a whole film that I put together that we took B-roll from, for example, showing a monkey that goes out and walks a dog and has to figure out how to get by across a stream. And it's brilliant to watch the intelligence going on to this monkey walking the dog, but also saving the dog, and watching animals save each other, watching a dog go onto a highway where a dog has been hit. By the way, this is a strange dog. He doesn't know the dog's been hit. And then grabbing the dog that's been down, is not moving, and grabbing it around the neck and pulling it across the road to safety. I show dozens of scenes where there's a orangutan that feeds out of a bottle, feeds baby tigers and then plays with them. And then as those tigers grow up to be 700 pounds, they think that orangutan is its mother. In fact, the cutest thing is seeing a little dachshund nurturing two lions, big lions, and licking their faces and grooming them. Then they grow up to be full-grown lions. And here's this little tiny dachshund going over there and licking their faces and opening her paw, looking in their mouth to see everything is all right in their mouth, stick her head in their mouth. And yeah, there's the giant lion, you know, kind of, okay, mom, you know, my teeth's all right. And then the mom's sleeping right there with the big lions. The bonds between creatures, the sacrifices creatures make for each other, the nurturing. And then, of course, if you have your own companion pet, the love that you see, the patience you see, the forgiveness you see, the trust that you see between the creature that you have that's so personal to you, that you love, that's a member of your family. But then you go into a restaurant and you have a veal parmesan without realizing that calf was taken away immediately from its mother and deprived of mother milk, so it's deprived of iron, so it has whiter flesh, because we say, oh, we want the soft white flesh, not realizing the sacrifice, the sow that never gets to see its own piglets because she's kept in a cage and can't move. And so I show monkeys being eaten alive in Vietnam, and dogs and cats and kittens being stripped alive and boiled or barbecued or roasted in China, in Korea, in the Philippines. And yet if you said, well,